blockchain is a ledger which is stored simultaneously across many computers. It uses the architecture of the internet, but differs from the internet in that the information on a blockchain is not mutable. In this sense, it replicates a paper ledger, an ink, perhaps a vault. But in the case of blockchains, the vault is an abstract machine composed of a large array of computers, which we call decentralized. This decentralized quality of blockchains underpins the immutability of the information on them. To change the information, you'd have to do so simultaneously in all instances of the ledger, which is impossible, at least for now. This decentralized quality also means that the ledger, like a notice board, is ostensibly public, can be seen and added to by anyone who wishes to, anytime, without permission from any central authority. From these simple premises, lots of very notorious and some less notorious instantiations have been developed. Among them, the first implementation of a blockchain was Bitcoin, which we're all have heard of and are sick of hearing about. Well over 1,340 other cryptocurrencies. What has also been done with blockchains is that some blockchains have been designed so that algorithms can run on them. Blockchains such as Ethereum, on which active autonomous algorithms can be set to run at least theoretically, in an unstoppable way. My friend Ruth Catlow has put it, this creates a situation where we have viruses with wallets. It's this technology that this panel and this book, which we're launching the digital edition of today, this evening, it's these things that the book addresses. And this panel, the artists and theoreticians on this panel will be discussing their own perspective on blockchains, what they can do, what the dangers are. My name's Nathan Jones. Along with Sam Skinner, I run a publisher called Talk. I'm joined by Ruth Catlow, who is part of Further Field, along with Mark Garrett, who sat in the front here. Many of you will have seen his performance last night. They're with Further Field, who co-published the book. There's also Cesar Escudero Andaluz and Martin Nadal, Jaya Clara Brecker, Kaya Kreutler, and Sarah Friend. So I'm going to start, I'm just going to very briefly talk about Talk, our interest in publishing this book, and what we've learned from it. Each of the panelists will do a very short presentation, around about 5 minutes, and then we'll have time for a discussion. And after that, we'll be doing a kind of fire sale on some of the Artists Rethinking the Blockchain books, the print versions. And we'll be doing that in a way where the books have a radically increasing value. And you'll be able to buy them in bitcoins or ether, euros or pounds. Okay, so Talk Editions is a publisher. We are what we call a hybrid, an itinerant publisher, in that we work across many different partnership modes, and we also have lots of different things that we consider to be publishing, so it's an expanded sense of publishing. You can see our website here. It's actually a holding page, but what you will have there is the PDF download for this book, which is the first time that's been made available this evening. So do get it and read it if you've not already. The expanded and hybrid types of publishing that we do at Talk include symposia, exhibitions. You can see here a reading machine that we produced along with the artist Tom Schofield. And these in their own way, each of these things we think of not only as part of the publishing process, but as part of a critical practice, which we think of as being post-digital. For us, post-digital means a way of a necessity to reconsider things like print when you're a publisher in an age of digital technologies, where digital technologies are proliferating. But it's also a position, a critical position, in relationship to the technologies we're using. And we feel very strongly that artists, many of whom are represented here at Transmediale over the years, and many of whom are represented in this book, can have these kind of critical uses of technologies that use them without valorizing them. And that is essentially the proposition of the Artist Rethinking the Blockchain book. It's encouraging a use and an engagement without the hype. We're not salespeople for Bitcoin, certainly. So as a publisher, one of the things that there's been several sort of actual functions within blockchains, things that it can do, which interested us, such as micropayments, which might allow a different relationship between authors and readers, but also things like unique digital editions, which kind of might give digital books some of the sort of unique qualities of print editions. But more importantly than this, we were interested in documenting, enabling, and informing artists' kind of innate ability to critique the techniques of the blockchain as they emerged. And in this way, this is how we sort of structured the book across documents of existing practices in relationship to the blockchain. Fictions, which is a platform for newly commissioned work, stories, poetry, which reflect on almost the feeling of the blockchain right now. And theory, which hopefully acts a bit like a sort of primer and a workbook so that artists can kind of start to understand what the blockchain is and what it means. The need for this kind of book is clear. Furtherfield's long-term interest in the blockchain has been proven to be right. Since the publication of this book, in fact, there's been a rapid increase of interest and news around the blockchain and the issues around it. Many of the issues, such as that raised by Terra O, you can see here with their self-governing forest, addressing the kind of ecological issues around blockchains, the fact that they use so much energy and therefore are really environmentally, not only unsound, but environmentally dangerous. Also Rob Meyer's engagement with the kind of cultural quality of invented currencies, and the way that they're kind of authored and have styles which in turn is financialized is something we've dealt with in the book, but is increasingly in the news almost every day. Alongside the stuff we do address in the book, there's been, like, news is inevitably overtaking the print medium that we've sort of chosen for the book. So there's kind of been instantiations that we could have never guessed, and in fact, in the case of this one, would never want to guess. I was watching the news last night. This is Newsnight in the UK, a news sort of summary program. And this is the proposition for an app which would use the blockchain where men can ask women to put their consent for sex on the blockchain, which is just like, you know, I'm really glad that we don't address that in the book, but just to show you just how necessary it is that artists are engaging in this kind of technology and doing things with it which are exciting and needed. Okay, so I'm going to pass on now to my colleague at Talk, Sam Skinner.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to discuss a few aspects of my experience of navigating the blockchain via this project, but as an editor and a publisher, not a blockchain specialist. So following on from Nathan's blockchain explanation, for anyone that isn't clear, I've put together this slide with some blockchain diagrams. So if we just start at the top left. What I wanted to point toward was the excess of material online and the powerful and often pernicious feedback loop that operates between Web 2.0, blogosphere, Twittersphere, fintech, online advertising, etc., and the blockchain, which makes navigating the terrain tricky but also quite performative. This ad is a classic, that I see regularly in relation to cryptocurrency, a promise to get rich quick, linked to the aspirational image of leaving the city behind to explore the watery part of the world and waving to a friend. But if you do click on the ad, hoping to find the secret to eternal yachting, one is greeted with a book. And when you click on it, it takes you through to signing up to a pay monthly crypto newsletter. So the book, its promise of tangible knowledge, an object you can trust, is used as a kind of gateway drug to a more rapid fire information updates, and crypto kind of cognizance. And also it's an ebook, you know, and it's interesting here that they show a physical book. Perhaps our own book is not so different, but rather than the bog standard gateway drug, I hope it's a more heady cocktail of psychotropic and psychedelic drugs. Where the blockchain is engaged with, in both pragmatic and fantastic terms, as a subject and medium for a wide variety of art and a means to organize collectively and distribute material differently. So it's this last aspect of distribution and how it relates to publishing, potentially, that was an initial catalyst to interest in the subject and conversations with Ruth, and I'd like to acknowledge, you know, how much work further field have done in this field, you know, before we got involved, but this idea of facilitating micropayments below, say, €1 that are currently prohibitively expensive to facilitate. And what this might offer publishing, you know, to do that differently, and maybe you'd want to pay a cent or a penny for a page, or maybe that's a terrible idea. But as often is the case with the blockchain, when you dig a little deeper, the reverse side, and these kind of flip sides, you know, emerge. And so something with micropayments is this potential to charge for almost every online activity, however small, from emails to search queries, and equally blockchain's ability to track and itemize things in multitude at little expense can combine powerfully with IoT technology. So as such, blockchain implementation has the power to intensify existing power imbalances, in particular where these intersect with technology. And I think one example in the book is Mark Waugh's essay, who's from DAX in the UK, which is the Design and Artist Copyright Society. So he is kind of a bit of a positivist for it in terms of what it can do in terms of post-digital distribution, editioning, and copyright reinforcement. But I think this compares to two essays in the book by Helen Kaplinsky and Rachel O'Dwyer that offer this more critical take on blockchain, copyright, how it links to, you know, other colonial, museological classificatory systems, and some of the problems inherent with them. So just to conclude, I think we need to be very conscious of the incumbent actors on the scene, not just incumbent ideologies, and of the blockchain being implemented as a tool looking for a problem, in danger of creating, as Adam Greenfield has written, a market where there was none before. So as Nathan has suggested, it's a space that needs diversifying as well, experimentation, and so, as you know, I'm not wanting to sound down on it, because I think it's incredibly huge potential, unexplored territory, and it's about kind of making claims on it and engaging. But at the same time, as I tried to make the point with the kind of montage with the book, is I don't think we can overcome it. You know, we are sort of in it, and however much you say it, a bit like, you know, bad publicity and Trump. So, yeah, and then just one other point I think I wanted to make is zooming out a little bit. So the thing that I found very interesting, through the subversive effects of the blockchain and how it makes you think about money systems, legal systems more broadly, and I think that's some of the most exciting stuff, actually, in the conversations I'm having with people, in that people are understanding more and more historically, you know, what those things, the effects of those things, one last point is just to thank everyone that contributed to the book. I think it's a testament to transdisciplinary art practice today, and quite a unique document for the multitude of different approaches to this one subject, and not a kind of. Classically in art, you often have slightly more ambiguous titles for projects, but for it to really be this tangible thing in this fast-moving subject. And this way that it functions actually as a sort of performative explainer. So I think actually, if you're trying to get to grips with what is the blockchain, I think the book functions really quite well in that way, that you've got amazing projects by some of the people we have here. Oh, okay. Amazing projects by some of the people here that are dismantling it, refunctioning it, showing its levers, I think that's exciting. And so, making it accessible while still, you know, critical and experimental, and I'm also excited about, you know, how it feeds into Transmediale, the festival. You know, I look forward to, hopefully you can buy the book or download it. On the talk website as well, there's a link to Liverpool University Press where you can buy it for £15. And I'd like to say, subsidised by a third party, the UK government. So I'll leave it there.
Thanks. I'll keep this one, Ruth. So this is Ruth Catlow.
Hello. So it falls to me to talk about some of the artworks in the book, which is a great pleasure and privilege. I wanted to start with this image, which is from the cover of the book, which was created specially for the book by an artist illustrator called Juhi Ham. Who came to us via our partners at the Institute of Network Cultures. Thank you very much for that. This image, it kind of really encapsulates some of the kind of contradictions of feeling that we might have about what is promised or enabled by the technology. So we have a raft of hands. I think they're feeling each other's pulse. So we've got this kind of, we're caring for each other, we're monitoring each other, we're somehow locked together, we're coordinating our kind of survival systems. And up here, we're also surveilling each other. So it's this kind of weird mix of monitoring, coordinating, and surveillance, which I think is kind of a really great encapsulation of at least some of the themes that we can kind of start to get our heads around. And I'm going to reiterate once what has already been said by both Nathan and Sam, that kind of our intention behind this book was to really kind of diversify the kinds of people, the people from different backgrounds and the imaginaries that we can kind of pull into this space. It's our intuition that this technology is going to be highly impactful for reasons that you will get your own feeling for, and we just need it not to be, for them not to just be shaped by a very tiny elite of engineers who will then make the laws and shape the infrastructures that will then impact on all of our lives. One second. So, I'm going to talk about three works that are actually currently touring with an exhibition called New World Order as part of an EU-funded State Machines programme. It's currently with our wonderful partners, Axioma, who are based in Slovenia, and then it's touring to Druga More in Rijeka in Croatia. So if you're in either of those places over the next couple of months, you can get to see these works and kind of get a different experience of them. All the artworks, and kind of what's interesting, I think, about artists working in this field is that they bring critical and playful faculties to do what is very necessary testing of the range of political, philosophical, and technical affordances of this internet of money. I'm going to describe the blockchain in very many different ways in the next 3 minutes. I think it's helpful. Let's not try and understand it with one sentence. The artworks in this show, so in New World Order, they envision future world making by machines, markets, and natural processes, free from interference by states and other human institutions. So we can think of the blockchain as, people are enthusiastic about the blockchain as a kind of new internet which allows systems to automate the interactions of networked objects and to fold financial transactions into them. So the artworks that we're looking at here are Plantoid and Terra Zero, and they kind of demonstrate how blockchain imaginaries are restructuring the relationship between nature, art, and capital. So it's a very rich brew, I think, at work here. And they help us think about the possible impact of encoding the parameters of all future physical forms and actions permanently, the consequence of cooperating peer-to-peer at scale across human and non-human divides. These are very hard things to contemplate, and both of these artworks help us do it in a very useful way. So we have Terra Zero, a self-owning forest with ideas of expansion. So this is a prototype for a self-owning, self-exploiting forest. It's actually, since we first started exhibiting, it's kind of progressing to becoming a real thing about which I have very mixed feelings. Initiated by humans, over time the forest creates capital by selling licenses for the logging of its trees and the utilising of its assets through automated processes, smart contracts, and blockchain technology. It sells its raw materials, accumulates capital, buys itself, and eventually expands into new territories. So we can kind of see a world in which human beings become the servants of the forest. And I'm a little bemused by the love that people have for this project. I think it's really creepy. You should go and check it out yourself and work out how you feel about it. It's as though the only freedom in the future is through capitalization. I think it's worth thinking about. 2 minutes. Plantoid, so that's this image on the left here. So this is a blockchain-based artwork. And this was one of the earliest blockchain artworks that I came across. And it talks about itself as a new life form, something that evolves. It's a hybrid life form. And it harnesses the forces of aesthetics and automated governance. So let's just talk about what it does. When the metal sculpture receives a certain number of bitcoins, it commissions another artist, to create a new artwork. All of those who contribute to funding the Plantoid can set the rules surrounding its genetic traits, I'm quoting the artists here, which they call its DNA, so that's its kind of material existence, and the soul or the governance of the new Plantoid. So again, there's these kind of slippages between natural and machinic systems that I advise you to not accept at face value. But we do have this sense of an artwork that is helping us to understand a new relationship between aesthetics and governance systems, and I think that's really useful and interesting. The last two pieces that I'll talk about very briefly, these are from the kind of fiction sections of the book. We have, I can't remember what it's called, The History of Political Operating Systems. So this is a retro future. I'm not sure I'm getting that the right way around. It's an interview with someone a long time in the future who is a political scientist who is telling the story of life before blockchain in all its barbarism. It talks about times when you could be born into a horrible governance system and it was purely a matter of luck where you were born. And isn't that barbarous and isn't that awful when now we have a system where you can buy your way into the governance system that most suits your personality. So it's all kind of the politics of preference. And last of all, I urge you to, when you buy the book or download it free online, to read Bad Scheib. This is a illustrated fiction, short fiction by Rob Myers, illustrated by Lena Theodorou. And it's a world entirely run off reputation. So there's no money. Money is taboo. It's based on the Doge memes, which means that it's kind of everything is mediated through this very kind of jolly, slightly kind of dumb and very enjoyable sets of meme speak. And we get to see feel the dark side of a world in which all of your interactions are kind of pressured by a need to befriend and be friended and to be liked. And that's it.
Thanks very much, Ruth. We'll move on to Kaya Kreutler. Hold on. I have it on good faith, this lead reaches. It does.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, so I have a pretty ambitious talk for about a 7-minute presentation. And I thought since there are a lot of artists and practitioners in the audience, it might be nice to sketch some initial questions, some very vague questions about blockchain imaginaries, and how they might relate to the arts or not. So, number one, when we're talking about arts in a very traditional sense, usually we think of discrete objects that are bought and sold, that accrue capital through financial, social, or cultural means. But as soon as we think of blockchain and the arts, we get into a space that's more conceptual or process-based. And often the symbols that represent the works of value are worth much less than the things themselves. So if you take the case of Ethereum pendants, they're not worth so much, but who knows? And it brings us to this interesting case if something can double as a store of value and an aesthetic object. And I think a lot of you might be familiar with tokens, and they're either going up quite a lot or going down quite a lot. And the idea of tokens is interesting and creates a kind of inverse incentive, let's say, where often if a token value goes up, the actual value of the platform that it's meant to incentivize goes down. Because if costs of transaction fees are so high, no one's going to want to use the platform, they'd rather hold on to the token. So what do we as artists see as that conflict, and how can we use it? Number two. So it's quite common that blockchain is talked about as solving a double spend problem, in the sense that if I write a message to one person and say, I give you 10 euros, and I write another message to someone and say, I give you 10 euros, how do you prove that that's actually a store of value? And how do you prove that those are different 10 euros without a central authority? But it also opens up an interesting space that solves it through something like a double identity solution, where any user can have an infinite amount of accounts or wallets, potentially anonymous. And since artists kind of like to play with identity, what can we do with this? And how do you govern without identity? So one thing that I think is super important to mention is this form of governance that's big and talked about a lot in the blockchain space at the moment that looks at governance as markets. And that's called futarchy. So the kind of tagline for futarchy is vote values but bet beliefs. So what does that actually mean? And I want to bring this up as an imaginary, not necessarily as... It's an open question, let's say. So in Futaki, I'm going to do a super quick run through. You could take something like a nation that has a social welfare metric. And you can say every citizen ranks their scale of satisfaction on a score of 1 to 10 every year. And you could put a governance market layer on that and say, we believe if this legislative bill for healthcare is passed, the social welfare score will go up by the next year. And you set a close date on that market. Everyone invests or buys tokens or bets on that market and says, if we pass this bill, the social welfare score will go up. Or they say, no, if we pass this legislative bill, it will go down. And this is a little bit of a diagram saying that. So basically, that market closes, and based on whichever outcome has more value at the time that the market closes, it decides whether a bill is passed. And so then about, say, like a year later, when the next national citizen welfare score is calculated, the people who invested yes, if the score is higher, if the citizen welfare score is higher, then those people make money. Otherwise, they lose money. So what does this mean for blockchain, for governance, as artists? Number three, so it's quite easy to think in the case of a system like Futaki that you could eventually, in a blockchain decentralized system, have automated actions happen automatically after a decision is made by market. So we have a really popular cultural imaginary at the moment of a kind of AI apocalypse when there's a super intelligence runaway and we no longer have control over this automated system that we built. But I think it's really important to look at other crises we have and also think about the ways that we tell these stories about automated stories. So once again, as artists, it matters what stories tell stories, what worlds world worlds, and it's important to look besides governance, besides markets, besides the straightforward narrative of blockchain, what tools do we have to work with? And how do we categorize them? So if we were to do an aesthetic narrative of blockchain, we could take the Ethereum logo and quickly place it into a few quadrants. Some of these might be wrong. But think through the kind of narrative of how can this one story be told so many multiple times, and how can we tell the story differently? So in my last example, I was going to actually read a short story, but there's not enough time. But I think a lot of what blockchain promises in a more utopian, creepy, strange way is a certain idea of interdependence. So if you want to stick a token on anything, if you want to put a market on anything, if you want smart contracts to mediate any form of relationship, then you could imagine it as something like a certain declaration of interdependence, where we're building a full technical system just to illuminate the actual interconnectedness and entanglement of things that already exist. And I wanted to frame this in terms of, as well, thinking through the declaration of independence of the internet. And if anyone's reread that document recently, I don't know how you felt, but it feels quite young and potentially quite naive based on where the internet is right now. So if we think through something as a declaration of interdependence for the blockchain, that might be the weirder utopian narrative that we could grab for, and one of the last ones that's still left. So that's basically it, and that's my Twitter handle, and beneath that is a Twitter handle for fullnode_Berlin. So I work at a blockchain company called Gnosis, and we're opening up, together with Cosmos, another blockchain company, a big co-working space. It's about 1,000 square meters. It's in Kreuzberg, Berlin, and we'll have an events program related to the arts, related to interdisciplinary and critical practices of the blockchain. So if anyone's interested in that, based in Berlin, and wants to get involved, please follow that. Please get in touch with me. You're very welcome there, and we want to make it a more diverse space.
Thanks very much, Kaya. Now we'll hear from Jaya Clara Brecker.
Hello, hi. So I normally work on consensus protocols, and I do political analyses of consensus protocols, and I can talk for a very long time, as these guys very well know. So please, if you can just like stop me at some point. Sorry? Good, okay. So I'm going to try and keep it really simple and just talk about the very specific stuff that I wrote for the book. Myself and someone called Elias Haase wrote a piece together, which was basically contextualizing something called the Satoshi Oath, which so Elias runs a company called B9 Lab, and they basically are one of the main companies that trains blockchain developers. He commissioned me to write a Hippocratic Oath for developers. And this was a very kind of particular time in the history of blockchains and cryptocurrencies. And so, you know, there was a kind of certain awkwardness or frustration that I had with writing this piece because I knew it was going to hit a raw nerve. You know, the blockchain had kind of come about, and it was really at this kind of moment where everyone thought that it would solve the problem of politics, and it would solve the problem of ethics, and we could get rid of that, replace it with self-executing code and very kind of nifty governance mechanisms. So, you know, the interesting thing, I think what grabbed my interest with blockchain, and I think the fascination of a lot of other people, is that it is this very fascinating kind of balancing act between basically the security of cryptography and the kind of access management that cryptography allows for, and the way that it secures the integrity of data, alongside a decentralized architecture which was meant to safeguard against authoritarian control, alongside financial incentives, which, you know, now has turned into this kind of like very interesting field of totally kind of creative experimentation of how can we incentivize people to do all kinds of things. And I think it has generated, so another talk that I did recently was talking about how this kind of cluster of techniques and technologies and ways of doing things tends towards behavioral engineering, because there is something about the kind of technology that allows for a lot of discussion of how we can automate certain things and how we can kind of incentivize certain types of behavior, but it really doesn't allow for a lot of discussion or a lot of space for actually discussing, well, what do we consider to be ethical or good, and allow for a kind of open-ended development of those ethics and those politics. Anyway, that was a little bit of a tangent. But back to the Satoshi Oath. So I was commissioned to write this piece, and it became an artwork instead. You know, I really actually wanted it to be something that was going to be alive amongst the kind of blockchain developer scene. But instead, there was kind of quite a big rejection, because it's seen as this thing that, like, well, if you start talking about ethics and you start setting up a kind of like oath or a kind of ethical program, it's too easy to game, right? I mean, if there's something that you shouldn't be able to do, or something that's kind of negative, well, that should just be part of the system. It should be impossible to do that, right? And we have the tools of cryptography and so on to actually ensure that, you know, a certain action is not possible within a given system. So it was really rejected from large parts of the developer community, and then kind of warmly welcomed into the art world. And I felt kind of very kind of like ambivalent about that. You know, on the one hand, it's great that it had a different kind of circulation. On the other hand, it was like, well, you know, this was supposed to be an active live document. Things have changed a lot since then. There has been a whole load of hacks and forks and various kind of like scandals and whatever that really has kind of proven to the blockchain community that things aren't solved that simply, right? Politics keeps creeping back in, ethics keeps creeping back in. The consensus algorithm, you know, doesn't solve all situations, and you have developers writing codes, you have miners that actually dominate the net. You know, it turned out to be not as decentralized as we expected. It turned out to be a lot messier than we expected. And so there is now a kind of renewed interest in the Hippocratic Oath, and it's part of the training program that B9 Lab is doing. So it's kind of gone via the art world, and now is like becoming alive again on that front. So in the chapter in the book, we really talk about some of these things. We talk about the reasons for why the developer community rejected this initially, why it's kind of taken back up. But another point that was very important for me to make in the book was that what really actually pissed me off... 1 minute? Great. I think I got this. What really actually was pissing me off at the time, which was around 2016, was that you had this... You know, Bitcoin came about, and it was the most fantastic thing was that we could create a global system for value flows like that. And we could recreate currencies, and we could kind of decide how we want to configure it and so on. And that was interesting, you know, that was kind of this ongoing active engagement. And then all of a sudden, somehow, it morphed into this really superstitious thing where everyone put all their faith into this system, and all of a sudden we were pacified. And no longer was it this alive kind of piece of code that we can kind of tweak and we can turn into other things. In practice it was, and in practice it still is, but there was this strange layer of superstition that was starting to happen, whereby you know, in some dream world, you know, artificial intelligence will start to kind of govern via the blockchain, which will be a much more clean and effective form of governance than humans will ever be able to do, right? So this kind of fantasy was starting to be created and was really pacifying in terms of imagination, in terms of kind of deployment, and that was really annoying me, you know? So that's kind of another thing that we try and discuss a little bit in the book, to really kind of bring it back into this kind of much more alive and much more kind of something much more grounded in actual hacker culture of like, you know, you open things up and then you recode it and you tweak it and, you know, we can actually keep this thing interesting in that way. And we can actually keep assessing what's working and what's not working, right? If there's centralizing tendencies and, you know, you try and do something differently. And that's kind of the direction the community is back in now, which is fantastic. But this superstitious stuff is something that, you know, is like, it's my one of my big missions is to like, pfft. Anyway, I'll stop there.
Thanks very much, Jaya. And Cesar, do you want the computer?
Thanks for coming. Bitcoin was originally conceived as an electronic decentralized system for capital transactions, where each node has the same opportunity to get a reward in this system. Nowadays, this system has become in a competition where miners have to compete for get this reward. This means a huge waste of energy because the Bitcoin miner network is the biggest network in the world. So this net is spending a lot of resources. So in this text, we analyze this problem in four different fields. Ideologically, technologically, ecologically, and economically. And also, we present some artworks to visualize this project that we were developing since 3 years ago. The first one is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the worst miner ever. Inside to Bitcoin, there is a Bluetooth microprocessor, which is connected with a mobile phone. And the mobile phone is connected to blockchain. So it's the worst miner ever because it's only certificating one transaction each 10 minutes. So one has each transaction. It's visualizing this problem in two aspects. First, behind this line of the computer, we can see what's going on, what the technology behind there is happening, and what is happening with it. So Bitcoin is visualizing the calculation process, but also the resources that in the exhibition space, you can see how during the exhibition space, during the exhibition time, the amount of paper is fulfilling the space. Next project is Bitcoin of Things. Bitcoin of Things is a kit able to transform every object in a functional Bitcoin miner. In this package are all electronic components and in a workshop. In a didactic way, we teach how to ensemble this functional miner, and we also teach how to what is the problematic around this idea of blockchain. These are some images from the workshop where some participants develop some project. Bitcoin of Things, we delayed the part of the calculation process, so we are not spending resources for getting the amount of Bitcoins. We generate a random number, which is the nonce, that is what we need to certificate. So basically, we take this this number, and when the object is triggered in somehow, this number is passing by a microcontroller to the blockchain and trying to certificate it, so it's working. Basically, it's the most complicated lottery ever. And the only workshop that the participant can get a lot of money. The third and the last project that I want to show is Bitcoin Traces. Bitcoin Traces is a software developing a data visualization of Bitcoin transactions. As blockchain is transparent, it's possible to track when currencies create and when the currency is suspended. In conclusion, these artworks are methods for educating people to understand what happened behind the surface of the wave of technological advance. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cesar. And you can actually see the Bitcoin machine is, those of you at the front can see that, obviously, that it's running here, but you can come and have a look at it, failed to do its job spectacularly. So each of the speakers so far are included in the book, but we're really glad also to welcome Sarah Friend, who is not in the book, and this is part of a gesture of sort of openness and acknowledgement, really, with the book that it couldn't possibly contain, sort of, never mind all of the possible ideas that are flowing at the moment with blockchain, but also just the different voices that we would have liked to include and may include in future things to do with it. Sarah.
Thank you. So, yeah, hi, I'm Sarah. I am an artist and software engineer. I've been working in the blockchain space for about 2 years now, and I also make games. I am going to talk to you a little bit about a blockchain art project that I made, and then if there's time, I'm going to have some general comments about blockchain and the art world. The reason I'm here to talk to you is a project called ClickMine. It's a blockchain-based clicker game. And with each click, the player sends a transaction to the Ethereum network, and this transaction mints a token. The token that is mined by this clicking is in every way a real token, exactly like the ones sold by most ICOs and traded on most exchanges. And of course, what is a real token versus what isn't is a broader debate. We can just as well ask, what is the real Bitcoin network? But what I mean here is that it is real in the sense that it uses the same standard interface as most other tokens. Which has some cool effects. This is the contract on Etherscan, and if you click on one of the token holders, you'll see the ClickMine token appear in their balance, despite being a kind of ridiculous number. Mechanically, ClickMine is part of a broader genre of clicker games. These are some other well-known ones. We have Cookie Clicker, Cow Clicker, and Paper Clips. I like to think of these dashboards as statistics fetishism, which will make sense again on the next slide. They share some common features. There's usually minimal interactivity, repetitive clicking, resource accumulation, and some of these games are almost totally passive after a certain point in gameplay. Something kind of cool to know, Cow Clicker, the oldest game on this list, was created with the intention of being satirical but became unexpectedly very popular. It had its own virtual currency called Mooney. Eventually, the creator of the game, Ian Bogost, decided to shut it down in an event called the Cowpocalypse. Where all the cows would be replaced by empty boxes that you could still click on. This is a quote by Bogost, intended partially as a segue to the next slide. Bogost intended the Cowpocalypse event to signal the end of the game to players. When addressing a complaint by a fan who felt the game was no longer fun after the cow rapture, Bogost responded, "It wasn't very fun before." Here are some other games that aren't fun. Cryptocurrency trading, another statistics fetishism dashboard. Social media, as we quantify more of our relationships, we should remember that we've already seen how this plays out. Within the games industry, some gameplay called grinding is repetitive and boring, or maybe meditative, depending on your perspective. And we also have games as in game theory. So this is the various outcomes of the prisoner's dilemma. This interpretation of games applies to most crypto mechanisms, also to proof of work mining, which you can think of as a guessing game played by computers against each other. So one of the things I think about a lot is the idea of software as a medium with formal properties, and similarly game mechanics and game design. And so finally, of course, crypto assets and tokens are also a medium with formal properties. So not so much tokenizing art and trading it, but token mechanics that are themselves art. So some examples of how that works in ClickMine. These are ways that ClickMine token is designed to hopefully subvert the idea of a token as having value, exploiting various bugs and assumptions. So in the final stages of the game, this is what you see. And then you click, and this is what you see. And I'm going to play that again. Watch right here. So you see this, and you click, and you'll see that your token balance has actually gone down. So this is a deliberate integer overflow. A number in the Ethereum virtual machine only has so many possible bits. And if you take the max possible integer and you add one to it, because it no longer has space to store any more, it will roll over or overflow to zero. So there's this moment in the game where you've been clicking and clicking and accumulating and accumulating, and then suddenly you click and you have less than you did a minute before. Another is that I left out the total supply parameter on the contract. So these are my token holders, my top token holders on Etherscan. And you'll see that despite having lots and lots of ClickMine token, they still have 0% of the total supply, implying that the supply is infinite. And I think I have time for my last section. So to conclude with a few sort of like free ideas or random thoughts about the possibilities for artists and cultural producers on the blockchain. There's a lot of proposals right now for sort of tokenizing art and trading it on the blockchain. And my perspective on the art market is as a complete outsider that gives away everything I make for free online, including lots of ClickMine token. But so some of these proposals move existing art market dynamics onto the blockchain, various non-fungible or undividable tokens. There are blockchain-enabled DRM schemes being built. I like to think of these as like CryptoKitties for the art world, which, if you've heard of it, itself proposed a lot of problems, brought them to the forefront of people's attention. This is something that Kia also talked about. Our success, in a way, raises transaction fees so much that people can't use our networks. So here are some ideas that I think are maybe promising. And one of them is decentralizing Patreon. So if you are a content producer, you are at the mercy of your distribution platform. If you split your payment platform into something else, then you have two channels, but that's not a very diversified career. I think we could totally decentralize this, and I think that Brave is an interesting step in this direction that I'm watching. If you don't know it, Brave is a privacy-focused browser with peer-to-peer funding. So you allot a certain amount of funds that your browser pays out every month based on what you look at. And there's a danger here too, of course, the most obvious one being the hate watch, where you binge watch something that you don't like. The piece upstairs that looks like it scraped Stormfront would be a danger here. But still, I'm curious to see how it goes. The second idea is the gallery as a token-curated registry. So a token-curated registry is a smart contract mechanism. It's basically a lean governance structure on top of a list. And token holders can vote on what gets included in the list. And the value of the token is determined by the perceived prestigiousness or usefulness of being in the registry. So this is a way we could decentralize curation or collectively own a gallery. And finally, for content producers and artists who do make things that it makes sense to tokenize as non-fungibles, these might be objects, things that I like to think of as bound by the DRM that is the laws of physics. Once the value of the non-fungible increases and the artist's career grows, that artist has no way to tap into future potential value. So I think we could do smart contracts that implement profit sharing with the artist and maybe also with early supporters of the artist's work. So I'm at 7 minutes and 12 seconds. Thank you so much for listening to me. And thank you to all my other panelists and to Furtherfield and Torque.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Sarah. Thanks very much to everyone, all the panelists. Everyone has stuck to their time, which is fantastic. So it means that we've got time for questions and discussion now for around about 20 minutes before we do our book fire sale. Stage manager has suggested that I very strongly suggest that you use the microphone that's on the side of the stage here if you have a question for any of the panelists or a comment indeed. So please do that now. Maybe while I'm just waiting to see if anybody gets up do that. I would like to ask, actually, each of the contributors about their encounter with the book and how whether there were any particular elements of the book which interested you, other contributors which maybe you weren't aware of or that you found it to be interesting to be published alongside. Well, Martin, you haven't even spoke at all yet. So.
I will speak a little, you know. No, I think that the book has been a wonderful chance to explain what artists that we work with blockchain are able to do. Usually what happened to us is that, you know, you say, yeah, we are artists, and they say, yeah, related with blockchain, but really very few people or very little people know what's all about. So the chance to be able to know other artworks and also to explain a little what is your work, it has been a wonderful chance and very positive, at least in our case. Yeah, that's my...
So I wanted to bring up the kind of meta book, the Finn book, which is kind of a interesting example of what might... I'm not sure I'm the best person to explain it. But each essay in the book kind of has a QR code that takes you to a website where each chapter has kind of been pitted in a financial race against the other chapters. And I just think it's kind of like interesting extension. And also there was a passage from the FinTech article that I wanted to share because I think it's a really accidental sick burn. They say in their footnotes, in practice, we do not use the blockchain, but we invite the reader to imagine that we do, as it makes the technical development significantly easier without materially affecting the experience.
That's like an ICO. I mean, that's what most ICOs are, right? should I explain that one? Well, I mean, basically, so ICOs, for those who don't know, are initial, it's short for initial coin offerings, and most of them are deployed on using the Ethereum platform. And the idea is really that if you're going to launch a new cryptocurrency, you might not have the capital or the kind of ability in the beginning to actually develop the technical architecture, and you also might not have like a network of miners to actually like mine your decentralized currency. So the idea was to kind of bootstrap the Ethereum platform, so you take advantage of the Ethereum platform's technical architecture and mining network to launch a new currency. I mean, it's quite obvious what then happens next, right? Loads of people launch new currencies. They never build a technical architecture, and you have like a whole lot of scams that start happening. But so that's the kind of short history of the ICOs, I guess. But yeah, just about the book. For me, I think the most interesting thing, kind of, I guess, coming more from the kind of theoretical angle, is to be sitting alongside so many kind of practical experiments with the medium in a way that doesn't actually shut down the debate too much, you know? And it doesn't really... I also think that it's quite successful in not, like, getting too hung up on kind of either utopian or dystopian visions, but actually is kind of a bit more playful and keeps things open. Because way too often blockchain is discussed in these very kind of like either utopian or dystopian ways. So that I thought was great.
Great, thanks. And someone's going to ask a question.
Yeah. Hi. I've got a question to direct to the panelists. Second from the right. I'm not sure what your name was. Sorry. Yeah.
Kia.
Okay, to Kia. At one point in your talk, you mentioned that blockchain would enable people to, as you put it, buy their way into societies or political systems that are more in line with their values than the ones they live in currently or at some point in time. Now, this may seem like a really basic kind of question, and perhaps my technical knowledge of how this might work is not, you know, advanced enough to understand this, but my essential question is, like, what happens to the people who don't have the money to buy their way into these systems? How is that resolved in your minds?
So I think that's the most important question and why it needs to be talked about.
Yep. All right. Okay. So we haven't figured that one out yet then, in other words.
I think it's important to see that this is technically possible and something that's gaining a lot of interest at the moment.
Right.
There is a chance in terms of outcome tokens or other things that these might not necessarily be directly related to money as we know it now. So potentially it could be something, a symbol of something else. But I think that that's an important question as these systems take root and are treated as valid or and are built.
Right. Can I ask a follow-up question there?
Yeah, of course.
So outcome tokens to me sound like some sort of marketizing kind of mechanism for potentially, you know, seeing through what might broadly be considered desirable ethical or political outcomes, but subject to what is effectively, again, to me, I might be wrong, I haven't read the book, maybe need to know, what sounds very much to me like a speculative market. So is the proposition that you're putting forward that we're going to try to resolve these quite fundamental questions through a speculative market process?
I think that there is a proposition that that could be the case. I'm not necessarily arguing for or against in this instance. But I think that when it comes to creating speculative markets based on certain outcomes, one of the reasons to talk about it is that it tremendously depends on how you frame the question itself as well and how you create that speculative market. Because if you frame a question and the outcome is not one of the potential outcomes specified, the whole thing could be broken.
So it's very important to define things at the start very clearly.
Yeah, or undefine them if you'd prefer, you know?
I prefer definitions to non-definitions, but yeah.
But that's one potential kind of characteristic.
Is there any thinking about how these particular, you know, such process would not be subject to just bad faith speculation? Is that effectively what we're trying to resolve here and figure out? That's my last question, by the way.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. So, I mean, for the most part, Futarchy and similar systems have been tested more rigorously in academic settings and less so in kind of broader contexts. Usually it's like kind of has a line drawn around the community that's participating in it. And often, sometimes misinformation has been proven to increase the volume and just kind of general sharing of information within the market itself. But we'll see as that actually kind of goes into the real world, if that answers your question.
Yeah, something. Thank you. Cheers.
Okay. Do you want to? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just going to talk about the book again, which is that there's an article in the book that kind of deals with the exact things that I think the questioner was asking about, called the history of political operating systems. It's kind of like Ruth talked about it as well. I would just invite anyone who's interested in the subject to read it. And another project not in the book that is one of the really early blockchain projects that's still one of the most far out for sure is BitNation. It's a proposal to make a new country on the blockchain, which is worth a Google.
Yeah, I think that was, it is worth sort of emphasizing that not all of the contributions in the book are made by people who are like experts in the blockchain. If indeed there can be such a thing as a comprehensive expert in blockchain. And quite a lot of them were part of mine and Sam's sort of role in a way was to commission people who we felt had something to say to blockchain type ideas. And what sort of blockchain felt like to non-experts as well. And so there are fictions and poems in the book that kind of respond to either like formal conceits, such as PWR Studio proposed something called TextBlock, which was an idea for what text would have to look like if it was online, and we gave that as a commissioning sort of brief to some poets. And also there's sort of fictions that reflect a bit on sort of like what the mood is around the notion that we might sort of put our identities into some sort of independent organization. So are there any more questions or points before we move on? Okay, so now I can explain, unless anybody of you, no. So now I can explain this kind of game that we've designed for the end of this event. Basically, we have, I think, 20-something books to sell. We're going to start off over a 10-minute period. We're going to sell them starting off at a very low price, especially low in cryptocurrency value. You can buy the books using Bitcoin, using Ether. I'll just actually get off my slide. Using pounds sterling via PayPal. Here's the slide. Yeah. So, or euros, which is cash. So Sam will be taking cash payments for a book. Ruth is going to be taking Ether payments. Mark Garrett is going to come and join us and we'll take payment in Bitcoin. And I'll take payment over PayPal. So if you make a PayPal payment, I just want to see the proof on your phone that you've made the payment, and then you can have the book. The longer you hold off, like the higher the price of the book is going to be, basically, and it will go up. And we all accept bartering, especially for other print products. Okay, so drink, tobacco, favors, any of that. We all accept bartering as part of the payment for the book. So the book at the moment is on sale, just for reference, for £18 in the shop. So it is starting off at incredibly good value. Thank you.